Once again, we're looking at the Haftaras of the Book of Bereishis, and obviously much of it overlaps with various thoughts in the Parsha itself, because the Haftarah is connected to the Parsha. I just want to backtrack a little bit just to share with you a thought regarding the past Haftarah, in which there was a reference to Yaakov struggling with the angel and being victorious over the angel. This was in the Navi Hosea, the Haftarah for Vayetze, which talks about that. I just want to share with you a beautiful mashal from Rav Shvadron. And he says the following. You know, Yaakov is wrestling with the angel. Now, there are a few different points here. First, the Chafetz Chaim pointed out, why does Yaakov is the only one of our avos that meets this angel that tries to destroy him. Avraham did not have an angel that tried to destroy him. And Yitzchak did not have an angel that tried to destroy him. Now, there is a medrash that says there was an angel that tried to stop Avraham from doing the Akedah. But you don't find it in the Chumash, and you don't find the angel trying to destroy him. So the Chafetz Chaim used to say a beautiful thought. The Chafetz Chaim used to say that we know Pirkei Avos tells us that the world stands on three pillars. Al Shloshet Dvarim Ha'olam Omeit. And the three pillars are Torah, Avoda, Gemilos Chasadim. Right? Learning Torah, divine worship, which is prayer and korbanos, and acts of loving kindness. We also know that each of the Avos exemplified a particular mida. They were specialists. Avraham's yesod was the yesod of Gemilus Chesed. He prays for Sodom. His tent is open for Orchim. Yitzchak, who was a korban, represents the pinnacle of divine worship. And Yaakov, who spent 14 years in the yeshiva of Shem and Aver, represents the foundation of Torah. So although Pirkei Avos has a Torah, Avoda, Gemilas Chasadim, in the order of the Avos, it's Gemilas Chasadim, Avoda, and Torah. Torah, right. Now, the Chafetz Chaim says the following. Although a relationship to God requires all three pillars, one without the other doesn't work, even Torah. Chazal say, he who says, I have only Torah, does not even have that. Torah without Avoda and Gemilas Chasadim indeed is nothing. But, of the three, Torah does have primary place. And the reason is that from Torah, you will come to Avoda and Gemilas Chasadim when you properly learn Torah and you internalize the attitudes of Torah. But from Gemilas Chasadim and Avoda, that does not lead to Torah. The Chafetz Chaim says, the Yetzer Hara that tries to destroy us takes a long-term view of things. And that is the following. The Yetzer Hara is perfectly happy to let Jews do Gemilas Chesed because that's not going to pass to the next generation. Eventually, they'll leave Yiddishkeit. The Yetzer Hara is perfectly happy to let Jews build beautiful synagogues and have exquisite services because that's not going to last. So when Avraham exemplifies chesed, there's no angel that tries to destroy him. Let the Jews do chesed. If I don't get them now, I'll get them in a few generations. Yitzchak, let the Jews even have a Beis HaMikdash. It'll be destroyed eventually. But Yaakov Avinu, who introduced the concept of Torah learning, that is permanence. That is intergenerational continuity. That the Sarai Shel Esav has to destroy, because if there's the capacity for a permanent relationship with the Almighty, by all means that has to be defeated. And indeed, if you think about American Jewish history, which is the history I'm most familiar with, you actually see that this is exactly the case. You know, the first wave of significant immigration of the Jews of Europe to the United States occurred. Of course, there were Jews all the way back from the beginning, but it basically occurred in the last decades of the 19th century. And the first thing they did was to create social welfare institutions, and they had to do that: hospitals, fraternal lodges. They needed to supply the basic living needs of a very impoverished population. And as you know, some of the German Jews who did very, very well financially looked down at the Yidden from Poland and the like. And the Polish Jews, you know, who were much more impoverished, less educated in a secular sense, although much more educated in a Jewish sense. So they needed to create some infrastructure to be able to survive. And yet, their children, by and large, with some notable exceptions, became a lost generation. And then we come to the 1920s, the era of magnificent synagogues, almost all of which are now churches in inner cities, with stained glass windows and magnificent edifices. It is only, and once again, that whole generation, with a number of exceptions, but by and large, that generation was lost to Yiddishkeit. It is only with the advent of day schools and yeshivos that there really was a strong and vibrant Orthodox community in the United States. The Chafetz Chaim's words are very prophetic. And that is why the sorrow shel Esav is misnaged to the koach of Torah much more than he's misnaged to the koach of Chesed and Avoda. Because Chesed and Avoda are wonderfully important, but they do not ensure continuity of Yiddishkeit to the next generation. Now, but then the Chafetz Chaim makes a second point, which is very interesting. He says, the Sorrow Shel Esav did not defeat Yaakov, but the Sorrow Shel Esav hit Yaakov in the thigh, so Yaakov is limping along, hopping along. And that's why we don't eat the sciatic nerve. That's why you can't really get a good kosher sirloin steak, because the minhag is in many places, although Israel does do it sometimes, but in the United States at least, for economic reasons, the entire hind quarter of cattle is simply sold to non-Jews, because it's very, very difficult to traber. It's very difficult to remove the gid hanosheh. The Zohar HaKadosh says the gid hanosheh is symbolic of that which supports Torah. Just as the thigh supports the body, so too those who support Torah. So the angel of Esav could not destroy Torah from Am Yisrael. There will always be Jews who will learn Torah even if they're poverty-stricken. And indeed, in Yerushalayim we see so many examples. But the Achilles heel, to mix my anatomical metaphor, of the thigh is that the financial support of Torah is always going to be weak. And the Chafetz Chaim said, when he was writing for the Vad HaYeshivos in Europe, that because Esav had a victory, that the financial support of Torah is going to be weak, any religious institution that does not have financial problems, one must question its authenticity. So, Baruch Hashem, most of our yeshivos are Altaros HaKodesh, for sure, based on that standard. Now, you might want to say, well, gee, if this was the curse, if Esav was victorious, so the next time a yeshiva asked me for money, I would say, sorry, you know, you're cursed. You're supposed to be poor. What are you asking me? Well, once again, let me remind you, and this will be relevant particularly for this audience, that the same argument was made by Christian theologians against the use of anesthesia during childbirth. Because after all, right, these were male clergymen in the 19th century, and they were making the argument that God cursed Chava, that she shall suffer in childbirth, and therefore what gives you the right to alleviate pain and suffering? Now, the Jewish response is that a curse indicates a tendency that exists, but it is not a divine command not to try to make it better. In other words, God is saying the nature of childbirth is that it will be painful, but we are given reshus to try to alleviate pain. It's not a gezeira that you must suffer. It is the teva that God created. Same thing here. It is the teva of Hachzakas Torah that it's going to be financially precarious, indeed, but that doesn't remove our responsibility to try to make it better. Now, those were two observations of the Chafetz Chaim, but what I want to share with you, Rav Shadron, because this connects to Hanukkah, as well as the verse in Hosea that talks about Yaakov triumphing over the angel. And that is, Yaakov at one point asks the angel, tell me your name, angel. Hagidu li ma shemecha. And the angel says, Lama zeh tishal lishmi, why are you asking me my name? Rashi explains that the name of an angel is based on the angel's mission. And therefore the angel says, I have different jobs at different times. So I don't have a set name. Sometimes I'm this angel, sometimes I'm that angel. There are a few permanent angels, Michael, Gavriel, they're kind of permanent positions. But most angels have rotating positions. That's how Rashi learns. In other words, the angel is basically saying, I don't have a set name. Oh, but Rav Shredran wants to learn, I don't know what if he has a mucker for this, that the angel is actually answering the question. My name is, quote, why are you asking my name, unquote. Those of you who remember the comedic culture of America might think about Abbott and Costello, who's on first. If you don't know the association, that's okay. But anyway, the point is, what type of name is that? What type of name is it? You know, why do you ask my name? It's kind of not a name, really. So Rav Shredran gives the following mashal. He says there was a mashal about a farmer who was coming to the big city. He was a Polish peasant. He was coming to the big city for the first time. And he was told if he buys a ticket and goes into this dark room, he will see, it's a movie theater actually, he never saw, he didn't know what a movie was, he will see animals and people coming out of the wall, miraculously. So he couldn't believe it, but he walked in, he bought a ticket, he's sitting in the darkness, he don't know what's going on, and all of a sudden, out of that wall, comes people and animals and all sorts of things. And he couldn't believe it. When he had walked in, he had noticed there was a solid wall, there was no door there. He figured there must be a trick entrance or something. So he took out his nice, big, shiny flashlight that he had just bought, and he shone it on the wall. And, of course, what happens is when you shine a bright light on a screen, the picture disappears. So people yelled at him, and they said, shut off your light. We can only see things when it's dark. When it's not dark, we don't see anything. It vanishes. So what is this a mashal to? So Rav Shredran wants to say, this is a mashal for Olam Hazeh. When you sit in the dark, meaning you don't really think about life, you don't turn on the lights, then all sorts of things that aren't real look like they're real. Like a movie. The movie is an illusion. The movie is not something real, but it looks real when you're in the dark. Right? So all sorts of things, whether it's money, whether it's power, whether it's holding grudges, you know, whether it's the control we want to have over people, the slights to our kavod. And these become so real to us when we sit in the dark. But what happens when you turn on the lights? Two things happen when you turn on the lights. That which is not real disappears. And the things you didn't notice that were real, you can see. So he says, turning on the lights is a symbol for hisponerness, for thinking about life, for connecting to the light of the Torah, to connect to the light of God. Right? So that's the mashal of the movie. We'll see how it connects to Yaakov in a moment. That the mashal of the movie is that when you sit in darkness, you don't see the things that are real, and you see things which are really not real, but they appear to be real. Turning on the lights dispels that confusion. So he says like this. When Yaakov asks the angel, tell me your name. The name of a person, and certainly of an angel, is symbolic of their spiritual power. Right? In fact, this is an important thing. The Arizal writes that when parents name a child, a boy at a bris, a girl at an aliyah, or whatever, that is a nevuah. That is actually a prophecy from Hashem regarding the spiritual roots of the child's nature. Now, we don't always know what that means. If a child is called Yechiel, for example, you know, I mean, we can't always identify. And Bichlal, even in the Avos, even in well-known names like Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, there are so many dimensions, we're not always sure what type of aspect is in the person. But nevertheless, when parents come up with a name, even if they chose the name for all sorts of, you know, irrelevant reasons sometimes. They like the way it sounds, or it rhymes with something, or whatever it is. It's considered to be a nevuah, nevuah katana. It is a source of prophecy. Because a name represents the spiritual power of that entity. Now Yaakov is fighting with the angel of Esav And the angel of Esav represents Yetzer Hara, the Koach Atuma, the Koach Hara. And Yaakov is wondering, how do you trick people? How do you entrap people? Doing an Aveira makes no sense at all, actually. Because whatever benefit you get is obviously going to be outweighed by the consequences. A pure rational thinker, once you believe in Hashem, how could we do it? Again, how could any of us ever do any other? How could I speak a word of Lashonah? Forget about, you know, wanting to serve God. Let me look at my own self-interest. Obviously, the din v'cheshbon is going to far outweigh the pleasure. So Yaakov is basically saying, what's your trick, sir? What is your name means what is your power? And the answer is, my power is nobody bothers to think about what I represent. No, nobody asks my name. Lamazah, my name is, my power is, people don't think about it. They don't think about the consequences. They don't think about the cheshbon. And that is my power, and it's analogous to not turning on the lights. Chanukah is about many, many things. And one of the things Chanukah is about is turning on the lights, right? Every single day we add candles because we try to grow in spiritual perception. And whether it's the light of the Torah, the light of the Shekhinah, the light within my neshama, which comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? Chanukah is about dispelling the darkness. And that is why Chazal say, you know, we talked when we learned Daniel, we talked over and over again about the four exiles. That's Babylon, Persia, Greece, and which is the Chanukah story, and then Rome. And the Medrash Rabbah in Parshas Bereishis says that the four exiles are alluded to in the pasuk, in the second pasuk in Bereishis, that the world was Tayhu Vavayu V'chayshech Al Pnei Tahom. So Tayhu means jumbled, and Bayu means empty or confused, and Chayshech is darkness, and Tahom is the depths. So the Medrash says, Tayhu is Bavel, and Bayhu is Persia, and Yavon is Choshech. And Tahom, the depths, is Rome, because the Roman exile were still suffering. That exile, remember, Gullus Bavel was 70 years, Persian domination was 34 years, Greece was around 100 years, and then Rome keeps on going, because even though there's no Roman Empire, but basically whether it's Western civilization or Christianity, we're still in the Gullus of Eden. So it's Tahim. But Yavan is called Chayshech. And the Maral says, because the Gullus of Yavan was a Gullus of perception, because remember, we were living in Eretz Yisrael. We had a Beis HaMikdash. We had, in theory, everything we needed. But the Jews were blinded by their attractions to Hellenism. It was not a gullus of geographical dispersion. It was a gullus in which you didn't see the wealth that you had. Because remember, one has to remember this. This is fundamental to understanding Chanukah. That it was not just the Greeks or the Syrians persecuting us. Many, many Jews, perhaps a majority of the Jewish people, were Hellenists, and they were going along with Antiochus. The Hashmonaim were not regarded as heroes by many Jews. They were regarded as fanatics. They were regarded as old-fashioned people that are causing trouble for the more enlightened Jews of the first century. Right? And one could imagine, like people say, why don't you live in the 21st century? So a Hellenist would say, we're in the first century now, you know. Ought to be modern, live with the times. Yeah.
I've always wondered, why were we always victimized? Why were we always being chased? What? Where were we? Why didn't we fight back all of the time?
The Maccabees, of course, did fight back.
I know. Yeah. But do you understand my question? In other words, we are always being chased, chased and chased.
Yes. Well, you know, Chazal say that the word Sinai, which is Mount Sinai, Sinai, yes. If you switch the sin and the samach, comes from the word sinah, which is hatred. And it says, from Mount Sinai came hatred of the Jew into the world. Now, which means to say that it actually connects anti-Semitism with the giving of the Torah, in the sense that in many ways the Torah is the conscience of the world. It reminds the world that there is a creator, that there are values, that there is morality, that there are boundaries. You know, it's no accident that, you know, Hitler, of course, hated Jews even on a biological level. Of course, he didn't care if he converted to Christianity. Of course, he hated Christianity in itself as well. But Hitler writes, and again, you know, one of the great tragedies is, you know, Hitler wrote exactly, there was no secret here. He was a nothing, so nobody paid any attention, and logically we wouldn't pay attention to it. But he wrote exactly what he was going to do, and he did it exactly what he said he was going to do. Well, Baruch Hashem, he wasn't totally successful. But basically he hated the idea of God in the world, because God imposed limits. God restricted the power of man. God restricted the ability of the strong to vanquish the weak. And therefore he felt that God was responsible for the weakness and subservience of human beings. It was a war against God, just as the Chumash says. Amalek wages war against Hashem. Amalek doesn't just wage war against the Jewish people. Amalek is trying to kill God. And indeed, that's exactly what this was. So basically, Torah is a great reproach to the power of man to think that they control or we control our destiny and our fate. And the Jew doesn't go away. What was it, the famous German philosopher Hegel? Hegel basically said, and he was considered the father of history, he's a great, great philosophical historian. He said that all cultures have a maturation stage, and then they make their major contribution to the world, and then they kind of fall away. Greece, Rome, etc. Toynbee did it as well, but it was based on Hegel, was earlier. Well, the problem, once again, is Toynbee and Hegel, the problem is the Jews. Jews don't fit anything. They're still around. Like, why are they around? You know, an academic invests a lot of time in a beautiful theory, and Toynbee analyzed, you know, 50 civilizations. Right? So Toynbee concluded, as you know, the Jews are a fossil, which means, all right, you know, we can't really use them for anything. They're just like a fossil. But, you know, once again, the Jew is the eternal Musar to the world, you know. This is what Chanukah is about. So Yavan is called Choshech, because the Hellenism within Eretz Yisrael, you had a Beis HaMikdash, you had everything. But when you're sitting in the dark, you don't see the wealth that you have, and you tend to glorify things that are not real, right? So this is a perspective to think about Chanukah. Now, one other point I want to make about this, then I want to go on to this week's Haftorah, and that is the Maharal makes an interesting point. We have these four exiles. So the Maharal says each exile represents a unique type of danger for the Jewish people. Bavel, which was the first of these exiles, represents servitude and loss of sovereignty, because that's Bavel started that process. Bavel destroyed the temple. Bavel enslaved us. Bavel exiled us. So that represents persecution and loss of independence. That's Bavel. Persia, which is the most, Persia was a very small number of years, but the most vivid event was, of course, the story of Haman, Megillas Esther. Persia represents the genocide. So Persia is like Hitler. All right, Haman wanted to kill. Haman. Now, Yavan represents the threat of cultural assimilation. We have to remember this. Although Antiochus did indeed physically threaten our lives, but that was only because people, the Hashmonaim, were opposed to his religious reforms. Meaning, if Jews were to assimilate, he was perfectly fine. He was not a Hitler, right? So again, Bavel represents persecution and loss of independence. Persia represents genocide. Yavan represents cultural assimilation. Now, what does Rome represent? So the Maharal writes, Rome is like the Japanese. It does not represent a separate idea, but it is simply an amplification of each of the three Goliosos in different times and different places. So in Rome, you will have the Babylonia of Rome, you will have the Persia of Rome, you will have the Greece of Rome. Meaning to say, in this long 2,000 years of Golos, there will be places and times where Jews are physically persecuted. There will be places and times where there is genocide, like the Holocaust. And there will be places and times where the challenge we face is not one of physical survival, but of spiritual assimilation. So, if we look at, let's say, America, for example, we can even talk about Eretz Yisrael to some degree, then essentially we are there, we are in the Yavan of Golos Rome. Right, the assimilation, right? And indeed, that's a bigger challenge. Lubavitcher Rebbe used to say, it was easier to be from in Siberia than suburbia, he said, because, you know, in Siberia was hard, but you couldn't escape being a Jew, whether you liked it or not. In the land of freedom and choices, you can be whatever you want to be, and then it's so easy to try to escape. Now, even in Eretz Yisrael, I mean, obviously, Baruch Hashem, we have such a great, great Torah community, but still, many, many Jews are very, very far from the Torah, and we have obligations of love and to try to be makariv in the best ways that we can, but Western values are very, very enticing. Ad kedei kach, now this sounds so amazing, that I understood a few years ago, when people were going back and forth to Jordan, there was some notion of high school kids doing some exchange programs, but the Jordanian government decided that Israeli kids brought bad moral values into the Jordan in terms of lack of tznius and the music they were listening to, and like, you know, so you know, once again, that this is what assimilation is. Okay, but be it as it may, this is what Hanukkah is about. So that's why the Golos of Yavan is not just historical. The Golos of Yavan is the primary Golos that we're facing in Golos Edom, because it's the Yavan of Edom, which is the assimilation. Okay, so those are just some thoughts about Hanukkah and the like. And of course, I should point out, too, that it's not just other people. You know, Rav Hirsch used to say, and he was writing about from the perspective of 19th century Germany, and he said that the modern Orthodox Jew, writing in the 19th century, might be the opposite of the Murano of Spain. The Murano of Spain was a goy on the outside and a Jew on the inside. But sometimes the modern Orthodox Jew might be a Jew on the outside. But what are we inside? Meaning, you know, what are our true feelings, our true values? What do we truly care about? So he says we have to look at the panemius. Being a religious Jew is not just a matter of external behaviors, the right hats or whatever it would be. It's a matter of feeling and passion. And that's something that we also get influenced by the outside world in terms of what's important in our lives. You know, I don't want to make people uncomfortable, you know, but people raise this following hypothetical. You know, each person has to ask himself, but this is just a very intriguing hypothetical. Let's imagine a person was given a choice. You have a child. It is a very uncomfortable question in many ways, although maybe it'll be pleasant for you. You have a child, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu literally gives you a choice. This child can go two ways. One is that this child will be a brilliant scientist who will win the Nobel Prize and be so famous and well-known and respected and productive and have a happy family life, but he will not keep any mitzvahs. I mean, Hashem would never make a gzera like that, but this is hypothetical. The other choice is your child will be poor and have a difficult life and, you know, will suffer a lot, but he will be a shomer Torah and mitzvahs. And you can choose that life for your child. It's an uncomfortable question. I'm certainly not going to ask anybody to give the answer. But, you know, but the question once again is that we understand that all of us do have a Yetzer Hara, understandably, that we would want the easier life for our child. But in reality, of course, the choice is actually a simple choice as to what you choose, but easier said than done, so to speak. You know. So the question is, perhaps the fact that we struggle with such a question might indicate that we've been influenced by our culture as well. Yeah.
Child to be like Dr. Alman, who is
no, okay, but that you're changing the hypothetical, as we say. You're saying let him have everything. Baruch Hashem, Baruch Hashem. That's wonderful. All I'm saying is, I mean, I'm raising a theoretical question. In other words, if you only had this or that, as opposed to the mixture, you know, you'd have a bit of a problem. No, Baruch Hashem, you can have both. I mean, you know, Baruch Hashem, it's shayach through Bechira, a person can have both. And that's very good. But the hypothetical was just a theoretical hypothetical. Okay. Now, the Haftarah for Parshas V'yeshev, if we now begin, of course, in the Chumash itself, the largest, yesterday was V'yeshev, is the largest thematic unit, really, in the whole Torah. The largest story, certainly in Bereishis, and that is the story of Mechiras Yosef, the selling of Yosef, and the Haftarah. Yeah, because I'm going to do today Vayeshev, then I'll go to Mikes. Mikes will be Shabbos Chanukah, and the Haftarah is from the Navi Amos. Amos is one of the Treyaser, one of the 12, as they say, minor prophets. Of course, they're not minor, but they're called the smaller prophets. And Amos is from a city of or a town that we know, the town of Tekoa. That's still exactly where it is today. And he is described as a shepherd and a grower of sycamore trees. So he was a tender of shikamim and the like. There is an interesting debate between the Abarbanel and the Rambam regarding the idea of Amos. Now, Chazal say that prophecy requires certain spiritual milos. A person cannot be zoche to Ruach HaKodesh or Nevuah unless he is a chacham, unless he is wise, unless he is gibor. Now we'll explain what this. Gibor means strong. Now we'll see what that means. Oshir, wealthy, vianaf, and humble. Now, right, so it's four qualities. Chacham, Gibor, Oshir, Anav. Now, some of these are a little hard to understand. We can understand wisdom, and we can understand humility, but why would it be important for a Navi? What, a poor person can't be a Navi? Why is that? Why is it important? What, physically strong? Right? So, there are two pshatim that they give to this Maimer Chazal. One Maimer Chazal is that really the most important quality is humility. But if a person has no other good qualities, there's nothing to be humble about. In other words, the chiddush of the Maimer is, even though you're a chacham, a gibor, and an usher, you're still an anaf. Meaning, it's not saying you have to be rich, but it's saying your humility has to be such that even if you'd have all those other qualities, you would still be humble. That's one pshat. There's a second pshat from Rav Chaim Volozhiner, which is actually very, very nice. He says that the meaning of chacham, asher, gibor, now anav is a separate thing, is really mirroring Pirkei Avos. Pirkei Avos says, Ezeu chacham, who is a chacham? So it actually gives two answers in two different places. One is, you lomed mikol adam, you learn from everybody. The other is, roes hanolad, right, so that's chacham. Gibor is kovesh es yitzro. So it doesn't mean physical strength. It means a person who conquers the Yetzirah. And oshir doesn't mean rich, but it means sameach b'chelkas. Rav Chaim Volozhiner says very beautifully. In fact, otherwise the Mishnah is a little enigmatic, because the Mishnah starts off asking, who is a chacham? Now that implies there is some reference to a chacham that you're trying to define. Who is a chacham? But where did you mention chacham? So he's saying, Rav Chaim Volozhiner is saying that Pirkei Avos is explaining the qualities of a Navi. Who? What is the meaning of a chacham that you need to be a Navi? Lomed mikol adam. What is the meaning of a gibor that you need to be a Navi? Kovesh es yitzrei. What is the meaning of asher? Sameach b'chelka. Now, anav stands by itself, But actually, that actually ties in, though, to the last thing in the Pirkei Avos. It doesn't say Anuf, but it says Ezeu Mechubad. Who is the person deserving of honor? HaMechabed is where he honors others, and that is humility, because you honor other people, you don't hold yourself above them. Now, that's for sure. So everybody admits that to be a Navi, you have to have these spiritual qualities. But the question is there some educational techniques that you need as well? Do you have to go to Navi school, so to speak? Now, granted, it is Pashut that even if you have these qualities, you're not going to be a Navi automatically. But is Nevuah a gift? Or is Nevuah a talent that can be cultivated? Right. So in the book of Malachim, Shmuel as well, we read about the Bnei HaNevi'im, which literally means the sons or the children of the Nevi'im, but all the Mephorshim say it means the disciples of the Nevi'im. And many Mephorshim say that there were prophecy schools that existed. Now, again, if you weren't a Chacham, Asher, Gibor, and Anuf, the schools wouldn't help you. But if you were, you would learn techniques that could enable you to be a Navi. Even then, it wasn't a done deal, but it was a possibility. And these involved meditation, Kabbalah, we're not sure what the curriculum was exactly, but they involve various exercises that can enhance the faculty and the receptivity of Nevuah. And the Rambam actually writes, that Nevuah requires that type of hachana, that type of preparation. Now, granted, it could very well be that many graduates of Navi schools never became Nevi'im. On the other hand, I just want to remind you that Klal Yisrael had a huge number of Nevi'im, although there are only 48 prophets and 7 Nevi'os that are in Tanakh, because they have a permanent Nevuah. But Chazal say that Klal Yisrael had either 600,000 prophets or maybe 1,200,000, in other words, double Yosei Mitzrayim, and many of them were local Nevi'im, meaning they didn't have messages for Am Yisrael, but you'd go to a Navi if you lost your car keys. I mean, that's actually why, you know, Shaul loses his donkeys, he goes to Shmuel. Like, why is he bothering Shmuel about his donkeys? You know, Nevi'im were there for that also. You know, small, you know, a Navi had a role even in those types of issues. So the Rambam Shita is that Nevuah needs Hachana. The Abarbanel actually says no. Nevuah is, if you have the right qualities, Hashem might just decide to zap you, and you might be Zaycha as a Matnas Chinam. And he actually brings Uriah from Amos, because he says that's why the Navi emphasizes that Amos was a shepherd. Amos came from a humble background. He couldn't afford tuition, so to speak, to the Navi schools. And the Abarbanel learns that Amos is actually an example of a man from the field, so to speak. See, unlike Yeshayahu, Yeshayahu we know very much was in the aristocracy. In fact, Yeshayahu's father Amos was the brother of the king Amatziah, Melech Yehuda. So Yeshayahu was a nephew of a Melech. Yirmiyahu was the son of a Kohen Gadol, Chilkiyahu, who found a Sefer Torah, was Yirmiyahu's father. So many of the Nevi'im kind of have an aristocratic background, which could get them into the Bnei HaNevi'im school. The Rabbanel points out that Amos apparently was a very, very humble background, and he's Mochiach from here, not like the Rambam, that a Navi can become a Navi if he has the moral and spiritual qualities, even without Hachana. Of course, I mean, this is not a proof. I mean, the Rambam, almost got a scholarship, whatever it is. I mean, just because he was a shepherd doesn't mean he couldn't have been Bnei Nevi'im, but this is how the Abarbanel wants to learn. Of course, another raya against the Rambam, although it's just an isolated passage, is Yonah HaNavi. We are told that Yonah didn't want to be a Navi at all, so obviously he wouldn't have enrolled in Navi school. And yet, during a Simchas Beis HaShoeva, Yonah was so misameach in the Simchas Beis HaShoeva that the simcha of that experience elevated him and made him a Navi. That's why he was reluctant to carry out his mission. That too would indicate you don't need a prior hachana. Anyway, Amos is prophesying both on the 10 tribes and on Malchus Yehuda. And Amos is a favorite. In fact, Martin Luther King always quoted Amos, "Let justice roll like water." Amos is outstanding as a social justice prophet. That's why the Reform movement likes Amos a lot. Because the themes of Amos are indeed very important themes, but they are primarily Bein Adam Lechaveiro, the way human beings treat each other. He talks about the oppression of the poor, the injustice and corruption of the court system, the fact that people were lending money to the poor, and when the poor could not pay, they would take their children and sell them into slavery. Huh?
What year are you talking about?
Well, we're talking about, it's really the same period as Yeshayahu. Amos and Yeshayahu is the same time. This is before the exile of the 10 tribes, right? So each Navi has certain things they focus on. Amos focuses very much on the Bein Adam Lechaveiro, and it begins, the Torah begins, and this is why it's connected to Mechiras Yosef, that God will overlook the three sins of Israel. And the three sins, now he doesn't say which three sins, but Rashi and Chazal explain that even if the Jewish people do Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, Shvichas Damim, God might forgive. But when they oppress and they cheat, Hashem will not. That's going to break the straw that breaks the camel's back. And it says, Al arba lo ashivenu, I will not forgive them on a fourth sin. And it mentions, Al michrom ba kesef tzadik, because they sold the righteous one for silver. V'evyon ba'avor na'alayim, and the poor and needy for shoes. Now, the simple pshat of that pasuk is, it's not talking about Yosef, it just refers generally that they would pervert justice for bribes. Tzaddik often means a person who's innocent. That they would convict people who were innocent in exchange for money, and they would sell people out, meaning they would cheat people just to get whatever advantages they could get. Right? So b'pashtus, it's referring to general cheating and corruption. But Chazal say that both parts of the pasuk are referring to Yosef. Yosef is called both a tzaddik, because he was innocent and righteous, and an evyon, because he was defenseless and helpless. So it's repeating the thought with slightly different words. Michram b'kesef tzaddik, they sold Yosef for silver, and they sold him for a pair of shoes. And again, the Medrash explains, they took the money they got from Mechiras Yosef, and they bought themselves a pair of, and all of them bought themselves pairs of shoes. Now, why is that so important? So again, there is an interpretation that shoes were actually a very important sign of a free man, that it was common for slaves that you would take away their shoes to limit their mobility, and even symbolically express the idea, you can't go where you want. You're stuck to me. Now, they thought Yosef was lording over them. Yosef had delusions of grandeur. Yosef would be their king. So symbolically, when they, as it were, disabled Yosef and took away his power over them, so they thought, so they celebrated by buying a pair of shoes, right? That's the reference here, thinking they're free of Yosef. By the way, I want to point out that, you know, although it is a total commonplace to us that the brothers sold Yosef, do you know, and perhaps you heard this, that there are some Mephorshim who say, and this is supported by a very literal reading of the verses, that the brothers actually never sold Yosef at all. It mentions that Reuven said, throw him into the pit. Yosef is thrown into the pit. Then it says they sat down to eat. And then Yehuda says, hey, why don't we just sell him? But then the next pasuk says, the Midyanim took him out of the pit and they sold him to the Ishmaelim. So the Chizkuni actually says that it was Yehuda had an idea to sell him, but by the time they got to the pit, Yosef was already sold by these other fellows. And the brothers were sitting far enough away that they didn't see what was happening. So there are Mephorshim that actually learn that the brothers never actually sold Yosef. Yosef was sold. Now Rashi learns, well, the brothers sold it to the Midyanim, etc. Rashi has to put in some things in the pasuk. Now, there is a problem with that, because when Yosef reveals himself to his brothers in a few weeks from now, he actually says, "I am Yosef that you sold to Mitzrayim." But maybe Yosef was wrong. Maybe that's what Yosef thought. Who knows? I'm sorry, do you want to say? Yeah, this is what the Navi says. The Navi is saying this is an unforgivable Avera. That's what the pasuk says. But you know, the Sephorno gives us a Mahalach. Sephorno gives us a very interesting Mahalach. The Sephorno tells us that the brothers took the position that Yosef was trying to repeat a pattern that had already existed, where Avram had two sons, Yitzchak and Yishmael, and Yishmael gets cut off from bearing the covenant that Hashem made with Avram. And Yitzchak has two sons, Yaakov and Esav, and Esav gets excluded. They now see Yosef bringing Lashon Hara to their father, and they think what's going to happen is, and of course Rachel was the favorite wife, so they think what's going to happen is they're going to be disabused of their spiritual heritage. And they said the following. They felt that to be excluded from Shiftei Ka, to be excluded from Am Yisrael, would be worse than murdering them physically. And therefore, the Sephorno says, just as if somebody is going to kill you, you're allowed to kill them. So the halacha is, they felt Yosef was a rodef. And that's why initially they wanted to kill him. Reuven persuaded them not to kill him. But the Sephorno says they made a cheshbon that Yosef had a din of a rodef. In fact, the Orach Chaim says in this connection the following idea. You know, so Reuven says, throw him into the pit. Now you have a problem here. Chazal say, habor reik, the pit was empty, it didn't have water. Aye, that's redundant. So what do Chazal say? It didn't have water, but it was filled with snakes and scorpions. Now, if Reuven is saying, let's not kill him, let's throw him into the pit, but a pit that's filled with snakes and scorpions is going to kill him, derech hateva at least. In fact, the Mishnah says in Yevamos that if witnesses see a man fall into a pit of scorpions, his wife is allowed to remarry. In other words, the assumption is he's dead. Right? Scorpions don't like to be stepped on. They're fairly aggressive in that way. So the question is, what's Reuven's cheshbon? So listen to what the Orach Chaim says. The Orach Chaim HaKadosh says something that's very amazing and may not be accepted by many Svarim. And he says the following. The brothers feel that Yosef is Chayav Misa because he's a Rodef. That's their judgment. But Reuven says, you know, how do we know that we're objective? Maybe we're motivated out of jealousy. Maybe we're motivated out of hate. We're not objective. And since human beings have free will, listen to this, if we kill him, that is not any proof that God has agreed to that. Because the koach of Bechira is such that you can kill somebody even if God doesn't want that person to die, because God doesn't interfere with free will. Masha Enkein, Reuven says, let's throw him into the pit of snakes and scorpions. If he is truly innocent, the scorpions will not kill him. Because an animal can hurt, since animals don't have free will, animals can only hurt somebody. Reuven is saying, we think he's guilty, but we don't want to kill him directly, because we don't know for sure. In other words, Reuven's saying this is a test. If the scorpions kill him, he's guilty. If the scorpions don't kill him, he's innocent. Now, do not try this at home. I mean, the Orach Chaim is suggesting this amazing idea. And of course, this opens up a whole bunch of things about the Holocaust. The Orach Chaim is suggesting the evil that human beings do to other human beings is not necessarily decreed by God. It is the fallout of the free will that human beings have. But the damage that an animal does can only be if God decreed it. Now, of course, the big problem with that is, so why did they then sell him? If Yosef did not die with the scorpions, then there's a tremendous miracle here. So you see that when a person has hatred and jealousy, that does taint their judgment. Even if a miracle happens, they're willing to discredit it. So that's a whole, again, but the issue of Mechiras Yosef is a tremendous, tremendous blot on Am Yisrael, even if we have reasons. By the way, this Yosef brought Lashon Hara to Yaakov. And Chazal say the Lashon Hara that he brought to Yaakov, among other things, was that he accused his brothers of eating Eiver Min HaChai. Eiver Min HaChai is a limb that is severed from a live animal. So the question is, Mimanafshach, is Yosef lying? And if Yosef is not lying, how could the brothers do an Aveira like that? So here, there's a famous, famous, famous explanation from the Mishnah Lamelech, one of the great commentaries on the Rambam, that says the following. This is an ingenious point. He says, there's a fundamental machlokas in halacha between Yosef and his brothers. And that is the following. We know Eiver Min HaChai is forbidden even to a goy under the seven commandments of Noach. And Eiver Min HaChai is forbidden to a Jew as well. But there's a difference in definition between Jew and goy. And that is the following. If I shecht an animal and the animal is still convulsing, and I cut off a limb while the animal is convulsing, that is called an Eiver Min HaChai for a goy, and it's not called Eiver Min HaChai for a Jew. And the reason is because for a Jew that has shechita, once there's shechita, the animal is halachically dead, even if it's convulsing. Since a goy does not have the concept of shechita, as long as there's movement, the animal is alive. So he says the machlokas Yosef and his brothers is, what was the status of the Jewish people before the Torah was given? The brothers took the position that before the Torah was given, they still had the special sanctity of Yisrael. And therefore, they shechted animals, and the animal was convulsing. They held there was no Isser of Eiver Min HaChai, because they were relying on the definition of Eiver Min HaChai that would apply to a Jew. Yosef's contention is, until Matan Torah, the Jewish people are bound by the laws of Bnei Noach. And even though they took on stringencies like Bris Milah, but they're not permitted to take the loopholes that are available to Jews. So the brothers were doing right, and Yosef was doing right. Basically, Yosef's Lashon Hara was based on his understanding of what is the status of Mandor. Again, this is the Sefer. Well, Mishnah Lamelech was a great... In fact, I'll tell you, all of you have heard of the Sefer Me'am Loes. So the Me'am Loes was written by Rav Yaakov Kuli, who was a great, or at least most of the Me'am Loes, who was a great Sephardic Rav in Constantinople in the 18th century. And Rav Yaakov Kuli was the editor of one of the great, great works on the Rambam, Mishnah Lamelech, by Rav Yehuda Rozanis. Rav Yehuda Rozanis left all sorts of scattered notes, and he put this together. So Rav Yehuda Rozanis wrote another Sefer called Prashas Drachim, which is Drushos, and he goes to town on this theme, going all over, whether Klal Yisrael before Matan Torah had Dinei B'nei Noach, or they had Kedushas Yisrael, and he's the one that explains that this was the basis of Yosef and his brothers.
I suppose Yosef did what, there was no din of Lashon Hara that Yosef thought he was a god. Maybe.
Well, that's an interesting point. I would have said that either way, you know, if Yosef held there was an Aveira, to report the Aveira to his father is not a problem. In other words, this is always the case. I mean, if I see a child doing something wrong, it is absolutely not Lashon Hara for me to tell the parents, because the parents have a responsibility of chinuch. But you're right, it's not so clear that a goy does have an iser of Lashon Hara. Okay, we'll continue. I wish you all a very, very freilicha Chanukah. And may it be truly a time of light and inspiration. Tomorrow, okay, what time?
10:30.
Okay.
So should I meet you at Chapter Gate?
Yes, that'd be good.
Okay, great,
thank
like
10:20. That'd be great, thank you, thanks.
He didn't only accuse them of eating the flesh of a limb of but there was another accusation.
Mezalzel b'nei hashvachos, yeah.
And I was wondering if he was building a case, not that he thought they were really doing this, but he was alluding to what caused the mobble, that here they were already doing two things that had led to the Mabul, right, which only Noah and his family survived. Part of
so the regular class.